ruler of a boundless universe. Thou art great in power and wisdom, and we have come to understand through what thou hast revealed in thy word, abundant in righteousness and in goodness and in mercy and in grace. We come near to thee, rejoicing that thou hast called us to be thy children, rejoicing that we can address thee as our Father in the heavens, rejoicing that in the sacrifice of thy Son, thou hast invited all to come near unto thee, to be cleansed from iniquity, to find a welcome with thee. This evening, as we try to understand a little better how we might deal wisely with that inestimable gift which thou hast given us, our children, we pray that thou wilt bless our efforts to understand these things, that thou wilt encourage us, that thou wilt help us to be a source of strength and guidance to our young people, and more than that, to exhibit the same love and friendship and warmth towards them that thou hast shown to us. We thank thee that we're able to gather together in this way. We thank thee for that treasure, our children, and all the hopes that we have in them. We offer our prayer through the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord and our Mediator. Amen. I thought that we'd read from Psalm 119, just the beginning of that, not the whole psalm, because that would take us a fairly long time. Blessed are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord. Blessed are those who keep his testimonies, who seek him with their whole heart, who also do no wrong but walk in his ways. Thou hast commanded thy precepts to be kept diligently. Oh, that my ways may be steadfast in keeping thy statutes, then I shall not be put to shame, having my eyes fixed on all thy commandments. I will praise thee with an upright heart when I learn thy righteous ordinances. I will observe thy statutes. Oh, forsake me not utterly. How can a young man keep his way pure? By guarding it according to thy word. With my whole heart I seek thee. Let me not wander from thy commandments. I have laid up thy word in my heart that I might not sin against thee. Blessed be thou, O Lord. Teach me thy statutes. With my lips I declare all the ordinances of thy mouth. In the way of thy testimonies I delight as much as in all riches. I will meditate on thy precepts and fix my eyes on thy ways. I will delight in thy statutes. I will not forget thy word. Well, that's an ideal situation. Of course, it's an ideal situation where the young man seeks after the ways of God continually. And as we know, as parents, it's not quite like that. Sometimes our children have agendas of their own. Even if they were trying desperately to cling to the teaching of God's word, there are so many pressures on young people today. Pressures from schools, pressures from work, pressures from friends, pressures from all sides. And a lot of these have the effect of making them unsettled and uncertain. And then sort of guilt comes in the end, the pressures can become well nigh intolerable. Now, the fact that you're here this evening is an indication that you recognise this quite well. And our object tonight is to try to learn ways in which we might be able to help our young people in these times of pressure which they experience. Comes with the age that they are, comes with the age in which we live. And we're particularly privileged tonight to have Martin Gehr with us. Martin is actually highly skilled in this kind of thing because it's what he does for a living. And I'm sure that what he has to say to us will be of great benefit. So, without further ado, thank you, Martin.
Thanks, Kevin.
think with this, or I've got to do that, then you end up, it doesn't go right in that sort of setting.
When you talk to some teenagers, it's a major issue in their lives, because you talk to them about rejection. Well, they feel a sense of rejection of their own identity by this.
By the community, or?
Well, parents.
Parents in particular, yeah. I mean, it's a let me give you an example. I might be one of those parents, actually, that sort of the frowning. I have traditional values around sort of behaviour and courtesy and respect. And in our church that I go to, there's sort of an evening service where most of the youth go to. And they come in and they wear hats. Well, I was sort of brought up that when you go inside a building, you take your hat off, okay? And they sit in the church seats and then they put their feet up and sling them over the seat in the front. Well, to me, that's the ultimate in disrespect, okay? And that's probably not their intention in doing it, but it's something I look at and think, well, no, you know, and certainly my own son, if I saw him do that, say, when you're at church, you don't do that. It's a very disrespectful thing to do. And what I wonder about is, well, do those young people, I never say anything, I sort of think, well, they're not my kids, it's not my place to be saying anything about it, but they may sense my thoughts about that. And is that a good thing or a bad thing? Like, how should the church community be responding to something like that? Does anyone have any thoughts about that? Yep. Yeah.
And perhaps in your same situation where you don't talk to them about the bad behaviour, you still interest yourself in their life. And then if they're still coming along, whatever, and other people are conforming, oftentimes they end up doing the same. But if not, they've found somebody who can relate to them.
Okay. So it's about, so for those of you who can't hear, that about still treating and talking to those adolescents in a reasonable sort of way. I often think that, like with me sort of seeing those things that I don't particularly approve of, I think, well, I don't have, you know, there's lots of young people there. I don't know them all. I don't know them really well. I know some of them, and those that I know well, I might be able to say something to. But if I don't have the relationship with them, it's entirely inappropriate for me to be saying something or doing something. But I would say, oh, well, there's people within the youth group, or, you know, the leaders in the youth group who know those youth who are better in a position to say something about it, if it's appropriate to say something about it.
And I think, Martin, too, as a church community, we are an extended family. So the same principle applies that you brought out about a parent communicating with their child in letting them know when they're doing it right.
Yeah.
So if they're hearing things from you when they're doing it right,
yep,
then the feet over the chair or the, you know, the dress that you don't like or whatever,
yep,
it might be that you think isn't appropriate, isn't as big an issue,
yep,
as, you know, we as parents,
yep,
think it is. It could be something that they're just sort of part of the adolescent thing,
yep,
that they're going through, and
yep,
there will be an end.
Okay, Chris said several things then. The first point was about noticing when they do it right, that's really important. The second part, I've now lost it.
Well, it was more of saying, Martin, that if you have that conversation with,
yep,
young people in which you're able to praise them for the good things they've done,
yep,
then you're not dropping a bombshell on them.
That's
and
right.
Saying, I really don't like what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's the first time you've spoken to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also a principle where I could be asking myself some of the questions I put up here tonight. Let me ask myself the question, is it more important that those young people attend church willingly, maybe with some behaviours that I don't necessarily approve of, or is it more important that they conform to my view, my particular view of respect? Often they're the sorts of questions that we need to ask ourselves if we're spending time with teenagers.
That was the second part.
Yeah.
Then what our issue doesn't seem so big to us.
Yeah.
Because we're seeing the adolescent in a context outside our own. So that,
yep,
we're praising them and encouraging them in what they are doing.
Yep.
That we think
Yep.
It's called in God's sight.
Yep.
What I'm finding interesting is that all this applies to adults as well.
Yep. Can everyone hear that? So, if you've, so your name's... Sue just said that all of these principles we're talking about actually apply to adults as well. Yep, which these principles you actually apply in your work relationships too, I think. Yep. Are there other questions? Emotional intelligence. Okay, the question was, what age is it appropriate to start teaching children about emotional intelligence? Shall I just, I'll briefly explain what emotional intelligence is. If ever you want to get me going on a subject that's dear to my heart, I'll give you a day workshop on emotional intelligence. The emotional intelligence, now let me talk about IQ. IQ is your ability to, you know, IQ can be measured on certain tests. Your memory, your ability to solve mathematical problems, your vocabulary, your memory for sentences, your ability to see patterns in certain pictures, they're all things that can be measured in terms of IQ, your general intelligence. In the last few years, there's been a lot more interest in a thing called emotional intelligence, and it's a fairly complicated notion. It's a bit slippery. And I mean, the first, well, there's almost five tiers to it. The first tier is about the ability to recognise emotions within ourselves. The next tier is to know when we're, how can we hope to manage our anger if we don't know when we're angry? So we're going to recognise emotions within ourselves, then be able to manage those emotions. So when I'm angry, this is what I do so that I don't punch the kid in the class next to me. Then to be able to recognise emotions in other people so that when the principal in the school talks to me with that slight tone in his voice, that means I'm one step away from being sent, you know, on detention or something or other. So to pick up those things. And then also, that's managing emotions, recognise emotions in others, then managing emotions in relationships. So when the teacher talks to me like this or my mum sort of starts to get annoyed, I know that if I step back and make a little bit of a joke, she calms down. And then the final one is sort of managing relationships more generally. Emotional intelligence sounds, it might sound very wishy-washy, but they're actually critically important to how people fare in life. Who here, who's a parent, would like to see their child grow up and be in a long-term happy marriage? Okay. What's the most important thing you can be teaching your kids now to best give them the chances of that? Pardon? That's a good start. There's a specific skill that kids can be taught that what they know is that gives them the best chance of having a good, happy, long-term relationship.
Communication.
No, more basic than that. You're going to think... Pardon? Yep, more basic than that. No, more basic than that. Was the first one, for those of you taking notes, was the first one I put up and you thought... To recognise your own, recognise your own emotions and be able to recognise emotions in the other partner. When they've looked at that, when they've done studies on couples who have gone to counselling, having all sorts of troubles in their relationships, and what is it that will predict whether that relationship will last in the long term? Is it that they have marital counselling? Is it whether they go to church? Is it whether they have a certain income? Is it whether they're employed or whatever? No. The most important skill is whether those two people can recognise the emotions in the other. Okay? Basic skill of emotional intelligence. And you think, so that's why, you know, often people sort of think, oh, they're the warm, fuzzy things that schools are getting into these days that don't help them learn the three R's. These are actually the really, really important things that determine whether they're going to be happy in life or not, or have decent sorts of relationships. In terms of your basic question about when is it appropriate to start teaching kids about emotional intelligence, they learn that from the moment they are born. There's lots of research that looks at now about what goes on. I've been to these training days on it, that what goes on between a mother when she holds her baby think, oh, they just hold babies. No, you sit there watching two concurrent videos, contemporaneous videos, of the baby's face and the mother's face and the dance that goes on with their eyes and their emotions. And what they're learning there is the skills that will help them sustain long-term marriages down the track, you know, from the moment they're born. And it's actually a whole area that is a very big area. And kids learn it, on the whole, kids learn the skills of emotional intelligence by watching their parents, okay? So if I go back to my point about, you know, be the sort of person you'd like your child to be, if you're a selfish person in the relationships in your life, then that's probably what your kids are going to be. If you're somebody that is sensitive to the needs of others, then that's probably the way your kids are going to grow up. If you're somebody that has a genuine concern for the poor and the downtrodden, chances are that's the way your kids are going to grow up. You know, these, and generally they don't come because parents say it's really important to sort of behave in these sorts of ways. Kids pick it up. So that's why, I mean, it's a very short answer to a very big question, but tonight the shortest way of answering is to say those skills of emotional intelligence are absorbed by what kids see in their parents. So I come back to my final point on that first lot of overheads about live the way you would like to see your teenager live. So that's a sort of a short answer to a very long question, I'm afraid. Is that, does that sort of half answer it? Or did you have something specific in that you wanted to answer? Okay, so you're actually saying, can we talk and teach emotional intelligence to... partly we can, okay? But let me go back to... I'm going to sound like a broken record. Let me go back to a piece of research. I'll just describe the bit of research and it'll answer an important question. There were some cheeky psychologists who thought they'd do some research looking at what influences the way kids behave. And they got like this sort of gambling type machine, like a pinball machine that they could win some money on, okay? And then next to it, they had a charity box. And they got in four groups of kids. And they, first of all, the kids would watch an adult play this machine and they won some money. So they get the money out. And before they walk off, they have to pass this charity box. First adult says, in front of a group of kids, says, it's really important to give to the poor and put some money in, okay? Then all the kids have a go and they watch what the kids do. The next adult with a different group of kids comes in, wins some money, says, it's really important to give to the poor, and then keeps walking straight past the charity box, okay? Next adult with a group of kids wins some money and says, oh, I don't like giving to the poor. They need to learn to help themselves, and keeps walking, all right? Then the last adult, the fourth one, wins some money, says, oh, I don't want to give money to the poor. They need to learn to help themselves, but then still puts some money in and keeps walking. And then what they did was all of those kids then got a chance to play the game, win some money, and walk past the charity box. And what they did was they measured all the responses of all the kids with the different adults saying certain things and then behaving in different ways. And what they found was very simple. Basically, what you say to kids has no influence. How you behave is the thing that influences them. So even when parents say one thing and do another, for good or worse or whatever, what you do is the thing that has influence. That's really, really important, because particularly for parents of teenagers, because often if we see the teenager not doing the right thing, we think, oh, maybe I should talk to them about it. Perhaps if they could just understand what I know about it. And I'm not saying that it's bad to do that, but come back to this. I've deliberately put this on the end. Be the sort of person that you want your teenager to be, because that's what we know 20 years from now will have been the thing that most shapes your teenager, most shapes your child. Other questions?
Just looking at the section when things go wrong, and wondering if number five, where we discuss being willing to do things differently.
Yep.
By breaking the pattern and breaking the expectation.
Yep.
The child.
Yep.
Probably we could pop in there.
Yep.
The aspect of apologising,
yeah,
to our children,
yep,
seeking forgiveness in an endeavour to reconcile,
yep,
which is a really, really important aspect of restoring relationships.
Yeah,
I'm wondering if it's ever too late to restore a relationship that might have come unstuck.
It's never too late to restore a relationship. Let me give you, I'll tell you about in my line of work, there's a great deal of interest now in what's called attachment therapy. That what we know is that kids who have good attachment or bonding or connection or whatever you want to call it with their parents are much less likely to get into trouble with their behaviours and their mental health. So there's a great deal of interest now, and it's come out of a lot of research that's just come out in the last 10 or 15 years about what we know about attachment, that it forms very early in life with babies. And there's now these sort of therapies emerging that focus on attachment rather than sort of, you know, punish them here or give them time out for that or do this or give them this limit. Look at what can you do to make that relationship work as well as possible. And if the relationship is good, then they'll behave better, okay? That's not always, but that's a sort of a general principle. But they've actually got this model that it's a new and radical model for attachment therapy with adolescents. So sometimes relationships between parents and teenagers go badly wrong. Okay? Don't want to blame. That's just what sometimes happens. And we can look at doing all sorts of things, but there's this radical response, and that is to actually ask the teenager about what their experience has been of their relationship with their parent, and then ask, where did it go wrong? It went wrong when mum and dad separated. It went wrong when mum started drinking. It went wrong when something, you know, whatever happened, okay? And ask them, what was your experience of that? Why did the relationship go wrong? How did it impact on how you started acting towards your mum or dad? And to get that very clearly, and then what you do is you get the parent into the room and just get the teenager talking again about what was it that we've just been talking about, and go back over it and maybe ask the parent, what do you remember of it? And then the parent can do something really radical. They can say, well, actually, I'm really sorry it went that way. I'm really sorry that things didn't work the way it should have and that I behaved in that way, or I left mum or whatever it might have been, and actually seek forgiveness. And apparently what they found that, you know, when forgiveness occurs in relationships, it can actually be a really powerful healing thing. And it's a very simple note. And when I sat there, I said, I think I might have heard about this before somewhere. But they're actually, you know, they're very basic biblical concepts, really. But looking at, I guess, finding ways of doing that in a way that sort of works well with teenagers. It's forgiveness is a very powerful thing in relationships. You know, we sort of all know that, but often we forget that in our day-to-day practice of what happens in relationships. Another question? Yep. How can step-parents form better attachments to kids? Okay. Can I just... I'll just throw in some general principles, okay, if that's all right? Let me tell you about those families that are step-families that come to CAMS, okay? Often the step-parent is the father. They've got into a new relationship, and the stepfather's barely arrived in the family, and he's saying, well, these kids, they should be doing this, and they shouldn't talk to their mother like that, and you should... Blah, blah, blah. And what happens is they try to exert... In essence, what they're trying to do is exert discipline before they have a relationship, okay? And we're all a bit like this. It's not just kids. If somebody tries to exert discipline over me and I don't have respect for them already, or I don't have a good relationship with them, it's not going to work, okay? So a very simple rule of thumb, this is what I say to parents in that situation, is that if you're moving into like a step family, in the first 12 months, the natural parent, whether that be the mother or the father, the natural parent has 100% responsibility for discipline, okay? That's, I wouldn't usually say that, but in sort of this sort of transitional time of step families, until they have a good relationship, the biological parent, who already has the relationship, has 100% responsibility for discipline. And the step-parent needs to be thinking about, what are those things that I can do that can be building my relationship with these children? And then it's not as if it's suddenly at 12 months, then you start, but, you know, the idea is to build the relationship first, and what you can do is not sort of keep completely out of discipline, but more be backing up the other parent. So the natural parent has the primary responsibility. That's like, it's sometimes more complicated than that, but if that's the basic principle that I would always get people to look at. And remember, for a step-parent, don't jump into discipline before you've built up the relationship. Is that sort of a reasonable answer? Yeah? Often step-parents, I need to say, often step-parents feel very inadequate. And often they sort of get a bit of bad press too. There are lots of step-parents who have very good relationships with their kids, okay? I took a referral this week of a family that I saw, a teenage girl that I saw several years ago, and her mother had rejected her terribly, this young girl. She'd gone to live with her dad, and dad's a nice bloke, but he's a bit of an adolescent himself. And they've started, because he's an adolescent, she's now an adolescent, they're fighting like adolescents. And it's the stepmother on the phone to me who suddenly inherited a 13-year-old stepdaughter, which is not an easy task. But basically, she's been there, talked to her, supported her and whatever, and has a really good relationship. And when it's going wrong, she's the one that rings me saying, I'd like her to come back and see you again, because she's fighting with her natural dad all the time. They're like two adolescents, those two. Can I make them come in and see you? Well, that's actually really nice to see. Like, there's a step-parent who has a good relationship with her stepdaughter to the point that she can be saying to her, look, come on, let's see if we can get some help to try and get this sorted out. So there's lots of step-parents who have a really good influence on kids. Yep. Are there other questions? Never give up. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Excuse me. Somebody pointed out that a number of people are taking notes. The overheads I've got photocopies of here. I've got a few other relevant handouts for those of you who are interested. They're down the front here afterwards. There was something else I was going to say. I know some people have to leave earlier because they've got to pick up kids or something. Feel free to go when you like. And I'll just quickly run through a section here on when things aren't working. Okay. Sometimes it goes wrong for parents of teenagers, excuse me, and I'll try and be brief about that and then sort of have a bit of a discussion. A couple of people said to me, I feel there's particular problems or problems that are peculiar to or sort of more, emphasised more for families that are in a church community, and so after this, you know, if there are particular questions or comments you'd want to make about that, then we can do that. So, I'm going to put that there. When things aren't working, these are just some general principles. Step back. Often if things are going really poorly, what happens is that When we get driven by fear, we intensify our efforts. We try harder, we might nag harder, or we might try and talk to their friends to get them to do something. And the more energy we put into something, and the more we see that something's not going right, the more frustrated we become, the more hurt we become, often the more sort of the teenager might dig their heels in, and it can become sort of a vicious, you know, vortex, really, into which sort of family energy can go. So often just stepping back and saying, I'm not going to do anything for a little while, can be a really powerful thing. The other thing I've got to say, it's actually, I won't go into the theory of it, but often the most change occurs when people start doing nothing, okay? And I'll toss this one in just for you to think about. If you're thinking about some situation that you're dealing with, it could be not just with your teenager, but with your spouse or friends or people at work, and you think, oh, should I say that's not okay, or should I tell them this, or should I get angry, or should I walk away, or whatever. Another option that we've always got is the do-nothing response, okay? Often if we're sort of thinking about something that's important, we always feel that there's something that we need to choose, something that we must do something. Sometimes doing nothing is a good response. It's often a very difficult response because we're driven by the need to do something. So stepping back can be really useful.
That might be associated with prayer.
For Christians, often, if you step back in prayer, it's about, you know, seeking help from somebody with a lot more wisdom than ourselves. But also, the physical act of doing that allows us to step back and reflect. You know, we talk about prayer and reflection. Don't get into blaming. Okay? That, I don't know whether people agree with that or not, because sometimes teenagers do things that are not right. Okay? I know that. And sometimes teenagers do things that are very hurtful to their parents. I know that as well. But going down the path of blaming tends to get people more stuck in the positions that they're in already. Okay? Now, this notion of notice what is happening when the problem isn't. This is a little bit what I talked about with the idea of praising when teenagers do it right. If we can focus on doing more of what occurs when there is no problem, then this usually produces more change than putting all our energy into what to do when the problem occurs. Let me give you a really typical example. Is often families will talk about how frustrating it is when children fight or teenagers fight. I think, when they fight, I need to do this, or when they fight, I need to say this, or whatever. Those things may or may not work to some extent, but often looking at what the family's doing when the teenagers don't fight and doing more of that is a more powerful way of tackling it. It's what C.S. Lewis used to call the shortest way round is the longest way home. The longest way round is the shortest way home. That sometimes tackling the problems the long way around is actually the most powerful way of changing it. Here's the one we don't like. What a teenager does is often linked to what their audience does. Teenagers sometimes do things that adults or their parents don't like. And it's very difficult to change their behaviour directly. But what everyone in this room does have 100% control of is our own response to when our teenager says something, okay? Ask ourselves, what would happen if I started doing the exact opposite of what my teenager has come to expect me to do, okay? That might sound a simple thing to do. It's actually very difficult to do because often it's around things that we feel very strongly about. And if I'm talking about the example of teenagers fighting, what usually happens when teenagers fight? Mum or dad hear the kids, you know, starting to squabble, and the squabble, you know, in the next room starts to get higher and higher, and then they start to get into a fight. What do parents usually do?
Rush to the source of the most noise.
Yep, they rush to the source of the most noise. They get involved, okay? And then the teenagers fight more, and then the parent tries to sort it out, and then they say, oh, it was him, and he did so-and-so first, and that's not fair, and last time you... And the parent says, well, I don't want to hear about that. I just want you to stop, you know. And it goes around and around like that. And the parents end up saying, they come to camp and say, I can't believe how often and how much time I put into this, and it makes no difference. In fact, it seems to get worse when I get involved. And if we take this principle and say, what would happen if you didn't get involved? Oh, something really terrible would happen. And I'd say, what something terrible would really happen? They'd kill each other. Would they kill each other? Because I've been a social worker a long time, and I've seen some kids get in some pretty severe fighting, and I've never seen one that's been seriously injured. And in fact, you'll think I'm a very naughty social worker, because what I have taken to doing sometimes with parents is saying, next time your teenagers fight, what I want you to do is to go in and say, this is obviously really important for you to have this fight, and because you do it so often, and even when I try and stop it, you feel that even when I get upset, it's still so important for you to keep doing it. So I'm not going to try and stop you, but I don't want it happening in the house. You can fight for as long as you like, but it just needs to be outside. And I'd say preferably pick that time when it's 7 o'clock in the morning and there's frost on the back lawn. Say, go out there, don't let me stop you, but you can go out there in the middle of the yard and just go for it. And that's the only rule. If you're going to fight, outside. And that, to some people that would seem bizarre, like, well, that's actually encouraging their fighting behaviour. I'm not sure if it is. But what happens so often is when parents are willing to do that, to do something different, say, well, no, I'm not going to get involved in it. I'm not going to feed that behaviour. They come back next time and say, oh, did you do that? I said, oh, well, we did it once. And they went outside and they looked at each other and laughed and then came back in. And what's the message of that? Is that the parent did the opposite to what their teenager had come to expect them to do. Because often in life, we get into certain patterns of they, you know, teenager says X, I say Y, they do this, I do that, and fall straight into the rut and it goes like that. And if we're bold enough to say, well, I'm going to do it a bit differently, what it does is it breaks that pattern. So often saying, well, what would happen if I did something different? Oh, here we go. This actually flows on. Be willing to do things differently. More of the same usually produces more of the same. But an unexpected response can disrupt the patterns we fall into. So sometimes if kids do things that really upset us and we are prone to nagging, then and they do more of it, then what we're inclined to do is nag more. And sometimes that's what happens when parents punish, because their child does something wrong, they punish them, it has no influence, they do it again, so they think about a bigger punishment. And then what happens by the time they come to CAMS, they're not going to get their video player back for the next 47 years. They're not allowed to watch TV until the year 2057. You know, it might sound a bit odd, but that's what happens when we sort of get into these escalating patterns, and we need to look at saying, well, what can I do differently that might work? Be grateful for small changes. Most significant changes occur by creating small changes that we keep building on. This is particularly important because often what I see with parents and teenagers, if things aren't going right and there's conflict and people are getting pretty unhappy and cranky with each other, is that the teenager might try and do something differently. And that might mean instead of having a fight at school every day for a week, they only have it for 3 days that week. And what the parents do is say, well, you need to work on those other 3 days. Okay? That's what happens regularly. And what the teenager thinks is, well, they didn't notice, so they give up. Okay? But if the parent is able to say, oh, that's really good. I was so pleased today when you got through a day at school without fighting, that let's see if this week was 1 day. Let's see if next week we can make it 2 days. So building on small changes is much more powerful. It's noticing the small things that go wrong. Be willing to get outside help. That doesn't necessarily mean going to a professional counsellor, but off being willing to talk with friends and relatives, not being sort of feeling like you need to keep it secret. There's a lot of good books around these days. And I've got here, in the long run, it is your relationship that counts. Parenting a teenager can often be a stressful and demanding time. It doesn't last forever. Sometimes parents can become so fixated on fighting the problem that the relationship between parents and child is damaged. The damage can last much longer than the problem behaviour or the period of adolescence. Sometimes I talk to young adults and they've got damaged relationships with their parents. And often it's around little things that their parents... The day I left home, my dad said... ..... and that's always stuck with me. And that's what we've often got to think of as a parent. I can be in a battle about a certain thing now, but am I going to say or do things that will damage our relationship long term? Okay? That's really important to keep in the back of our mind. Always find the time to do those things that you mutually enjoy that build your relationship up. It was interesting in the break when people came to me, because what people were... I had the most sort of responses around, and what you saw people got animated about when they got talking is the nice things that they like doing with their kids, or the nice things that their kids have said that they remember doing with their parents. Remember, like, that's what, when you came and talked to me in the break, that's what I saw in your responses. So that, it's interesting, is the final thing I've got there. So that's sort of a very quick run through. Some general ideas about parenting and relating to teenagers, parenting relating to adolescents. There might be particular questions you want to ask about particular things, or within a sort of church community, or about drugs, or I don't know, things that you might be what might seem minor things. So it's over to you about things you'd want to talk about or ask about. Yeah.
I've been around since the Earth crust was starting to form.
All right.
I've seen a few teenagers.
Yeah.
The thing is, in a church community, sometimes you can get the pressure, which is the peer pressure upon the parents to have an image or to conform, and that pressure is then downsized onto their teenagers. So the teenager's behavior reflects on the parents.
Yep.
In the community.
Yep.
Have you got any comments on
that? Yep. Can everyone hear that? The back? Okay. Let me ask a little bit more.